welcome, everyone. My name is Arzuma Seni, and it's a great pleasure welcoming tonight's distinguished guests, rare book and art collector Philip Ahrens, the Robert Lehman Foundation Chief Curator of Drawings and Prints at the Museum of Modern Art, Christophe Charisse, writer, curator, and teacher Alex Ketnik, artist Lee Ladere, and gallerist and publisher Andrew Roth. We are here tonight to celebrate the publication of Paperwork, A Brief History of Artists' Scrapbooks, with a discussion moderated by Christophe Charisse. The discussion is accompanied by the screening of Karen Schneider and Louise Ward's four-hour-long video, Scraphagia, showing the turning of every page from every scrapbook illustrated in Paperwork. Artists began to engage with the scrapbook in earnest during the post-war period, using the page as variously as the canvas, although on a smaller scale. As the title suggests, the book explores how contemporary artists have used the scrapbook to forge an intimate artistic identity in direct opposition to the bureaucratic administrative papers that provide official identification. The book includes and features works by over 20 contemporary artists, including Carolee Schneeman, Lee Ladere, and the collaborations of William Burroughs and Brian Geisen. I'd like to thank our guests for appearing in an Art Book Series event celebrating the essential beauty and importance of art publications with discussions and presentations by renowned artists, authors, critics, curators, historians, publishers, and others. Copies of the book are available for purchase and signing right after the Q&A session at the end of the program. Also, inviting all of you to visit the art collection at Mid-Manhattan Library across Fifth Avenue from this building, where you can openly and freely browse one of the most accessible and comprehensive circulating collections of books and videos covering every aspect of bookmaking and scrapbooks. Thank you all for your attendance, and now it's time to turn the floor to our guests.
Thank you very much. I'm thrilled to be here. It's always great to celebrate not only an exhibition, but a publication. And this publication is almost an exhibition in and out of itself. And I'm sure, please take the time to turn the pages. And of course, you have all of you that we are. So we have with us the two co-curators and co-editors of the book, Alex and Andrew, and we will go over the selection of those scrapbooks and what motivated you to choose those and not others. Joining them, we have Phil Ahrens, who is a great collector, a great supporter, and we have Shelley here as well. We both made that show and exhibit possible in many ways, and we'll talk more in depth about that later on. And finally, one of the artists who presented in the show, Linda Dare, is with us, and I think it's a great addition to the group just to understand a little bit how a scrapbook and that form is today particularly relevant to our culture. So we'd like to discuss the show and the publication, but I think it could be maybe interesting to start by trying to define a little bit what a scrapbook is. It has a great actuality in the 20th century, but at the same time, it goes back to the 15th century. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a form which almost coincide with the first printing technologies and hasn't changed that much. You know, like the book. You know, the book is still a book that was more or less in the 15th century, but the technique of printing have evolved. And we could almost say that of a scrapbook with the characteristic that it found a new form of actuality in the 18th, 19th century. With the idea of those books, those commonplace books. This idea that suddenly a scrapbook is not only to include a diversity of material, but as well to organize your thoughts, to create an index of your ideas. You know, all those fragments suddenly make sense, you know, as a group. And that's a very modern idea, you know, which maybe explain why in the 20th century they kept being used by artists, but not only by artists, by scientists, by everyone almost wanted to create some kind of testimony about someone or a place. And I was very surprised that even before your show, the magazine Cabinet republished one of those early commonplace books, you know, a blank book. It's the idea that this book...
Turn on your mic.
It's here.
Hello. I think you're sitting on your mic.
Oh. I'm sorry for that. I'm not going to repeat all that. Be lost for posterity. And what I found was kind of interesting is to see that in a digital age, you know, like this idea that the physicality of the scrapbook still stay very meaningful. So my first question, maybe to Andrew and then to Alex, is why scrapbooks today? Why did you decide to tackle this subject now? Is it because of its relevance in contemporary culture, its history? Could you give us a little bit of background on what was the impulse behind that project?
Well, for me, the project really started, as many projects of mine have started in the past, with visiting Phil's collection and seeing a facet of it that I never saw before. I didn't know that he had. And he was very enthusiastic about it, and he's been collecting scrapbooks for some time and began to show it to me, and one example after another. And as always, my interest in the material in general, and the reason I make books, is because how the thing exists as an object. And so my interest in Phil's scrapbooks was primarily in how individual artists created these books of things that they collected, and very often they weren't simply repositories for detritus. They actually became objects in and of themselves, and each one was quite distinct in their own way. Although maybe the notebooks themselves were generic, what was happening inside and how things were laid out and the beginning and the end, and or if there is one, the process of making it and how it actually feels as an object in the world, that's what interested me. So it started with a core group of books that I found in Phil's collection.
And Alex, would you add anything? Because I have the suspicion that maybe the content was as important for you. I mean, I read your essay about frottage, and what really surprised me, like you start this essay talking about surrealist artists saying that they act as detective looking for clues and asking this question, what do we have here? And it's a little bit the question I always ask myself every time I look at a scrapbook. Because a scrapbook is something which is done for sometimes a very private purpose. And when you suddenly discover one, the first thing is that, why are all those things together? What is it trying to say? So could you just say a little bit about your own attraction for scrapbooks and how they're organized?
Yeah, I mean, how they're organizing, finding the code, I think, was kind of part of the pleasure of going through the books. And I think all of them are kind of coded to a certain extent. Sometimes you would see kind of visual puns being played out. In one William S. Burroughs picture of Wall Drug, this famous kind of tourist spot next to the Great Wall of China, there's a kind of visual rhyming going on. But then you also get the sense that there's subtext and subtext and all these different kind of plays going on, that they are kind of pattern books in a way. Patterns are being established, rhymes are being established, but they're kind of tuned to different ears. And they're books not necessarily you know, editions of one, right? So a very small readership, maybe just for the maker, maybe to be shared amongst friends slightly. But I think part of the reason why what Phil had in this project appealed to me, I was looking through Klaus Oldenburg's book of writings that was just put out by MoMA, and there's this early note. It says, magazines, the contemporary reality, and then parenthetical, to cut is to participate. It's a kind of question he's asked himself. in a way, I think we could say magazines are no longer our contemporary reality. We're surrounded by all other forms of media. Magazines are kind of one sliver. But the question is, how do you intervene in that? How do you cut? Is cutting sufficient? You know, do you then recombine? How might we do that today? So in a certain way, I think the kind of objectness, the materiality, the precisely the scrappiness of the scrapbooks resonates in a way by, in a sense, kind of being out of place with our moment. Now, it speaks to it, but it maybe lets us see it from a slightly different light.
Phil, could you tell us why scrapbooks are so compelling to you? I mean, in a way, they are already a collection pre-form that you acquire as a group every time you add a scrapbook to your collection.
I mean, to me, the beauty of the scrapbook is the way in which it allows us an insight into the immediate process of the artist's creative activity. And I love their immediacy because there's no filter between the artist or creator of the scrapbook and the object. It has nothing in the way. So when you look at a book that's been published, that book has gone through a radical number of steps that involve, you know, writing and editing and proofreading and printing and selling, and the number of stages that intervene between an artist and the enjoyment of a published book are significant, whereas a scrapbook is really a trip to the, you know, we used to call them drugstores. I don't know what they are now. And you could buy a sort of framework for whatever it was you wanted to save in a scrapbook. And I think that's an interesting conversation maybe for a little bit later about whether scrapbooks are scrapbooks that, some are scrapbooks that look backwards, which I think are fascinating. Some are scrapbooks by artists that are looking forward in their thinking. But all of them are immediate revelations of that artistic practice. And so I would be excited by them, particularly when they were from artists whose work I admired.
So usually the scrapbook comes in addition to other works that you have already collected, or is it like more a starting point?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, I never think I started with a scrapbook, because the fact that they are unique, it means that they're relatively hard to find. And when you do find them, they're not easy to acquire or cheap to acquire. So it would come after involvement with the artist and a understanding of their other work and their other practice, and then a belief that really a scrapbook would be a wonderful addition to an understanding of an enjoyment of that artist's work.
Lee, could you talk a little bit about, you know, what this specific form means in relation to your own practice as an artist? I mean, you use a lot of photography, but often in relationship to contracts, to magazines, to collage, and so on. So you could see your entire practice as a way someone would put together a scrapbook. So could you just say, talk a little bit about the show and a little bit about more in more general terms about how you consider photography, for instance, in relationship to that form?
I mean, I think to begin or to add to what's been said, I think that it's very easy to, or it's useful to look at scrapbooks as being a, in general, you know, the different sort of modes of scrapbooking, whether it be diaristic, whether it be field notes, personal archive, a sort of site of fetishization in a sense. There are many different ways to use scrapbooks, and like Alex was mentioning also, there any scrapbook that becomes more than simply a repository for collecting things ends up somehow dealing with that coded nature. It creates its own code within that relationship of scrapbooks. And I think that has as much to do also with this transition from, you know, the very private use and private nature of a closely worked, recursively worked, even ongoingly worked scrapbook and the sort of performative nature around that. And then I think how that becomes public, how it performs in a sense, you know, to an audience, or how an artist might intentionally use that to perform. For instance, like Araki, you know, one of the projects, well, the project that I have included here is part of, you know, it's one volume from a three-volume work, and the very initial premise of that, which is set aside here, it came into being from looking at or responding to another scrapbook, which in that case it was Araki's Sentimental Journey, which mm-hmm. was a wedding album that Araki made. And the thing that was so interesting about that album initially was that he was taking a very, very private book, a private experience recorded in that photography album, and making that public. And so it played with all of those performative aspects of what we would typically consider a scrapbook. And, you know, so in a way, that project was orchestrated in a relationship or in response to that, and a complication of those things.
Can I throw in one thing?
Sure.
I realize we kind of have tough competition sitting here, because watching the video is so amazing and so mesmerizing.
But that's good.
Which sure. is a good thing, but it's also reminding me, I think, precisely this question of the publicness and the privacy of the scrapbook form. You know, we think of it as a kind of introverted practice, that of the scrapbooker, a kind of, you know, sentimental hoarder. This book is a book by Bridget Berlin, who was a kind of central member of Andy Warhol's factory scene, and she was a kind of manic recorder in all different forms. So I think she actually kind of introduced the tape recorder to Warhol. That was kind of her invention, to go around taping everything. She was also made all these books, trip books with people doodling when they were tripping, cock books, collecting impressions of members of people in her scene. In this book, it actually started, she came from a very prominent family. This was the social register of the Berlin household. And she kind of commandeered it and turned it to other ends. And she had her different friends kind of scrap in it. So there's Ray Johnson, Al Hansen, John Cale, a huge variety of people. But it really gives a sense of a social world that it is kind of then making private, that it is archiving. But I think one thing we found when we were kind of assembling the books and thinking about what we might add was this incredible, there's a talk, I think, intertextuality or inter-scrap-ality, because, you know, Al Hansen has something that looks like a Ray Johnson, everyone has Warhol, you know, all these people are kind of scrapping each other. It's kind of this scrapped together world, the scrappy world somehow. And so the kind of social nature is so interesting. Obviously, there's the kind of, you know, desire to kind of privatize the public or to privatize a kind of mass medium. But there's also a desire to kind of re-socialize, I think, or kind of make another kind of collective form. And I think it's been said, but this is the film Karen Schneider made with Louise
Ward.
And Karen is here. It should be noted.
You see, one of the things that the scrapbook can achieve is to memorialize a relationship, a situation. One thing which is, I think, is so fascinating in this object, that often there is this kind of collective authorship. Like, it's hard to, and if you think of, not only of the books you selected, but if you think earlier in the century, if you think about someone like Kruchonik making a scrapbook about Trochenko and Stepanova, trying to, including their own works, you know, so Prince photograph, or if you think of Carl Andre doing Passport, you know, this kind of extraordinary scrapbook where suddenly some of the key drawings by Frank Stella, you know, are glued among the pages. So this idea that it goes much further than just documenting something, but being something of a testimony of a collective relationship between artists, between poets, and so on. And it's maybe one of the reasons why so many books of your selection are from the 60s and 70s, when those things become so central to the scene. Anyone would like to add anything to that?
Well, there's something very democratizing mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. all the things that enter the scrapbook. Mm-hmm. They all take equal place on the stage of the scrapbook. Like the Burroughs Geisen scrapbooks, we know that both of them worked on them, but we can't really pinpoint who laid down that picture, mm-hmm. you know, who was responding to who at what moment. And I think it's part of the wonderment of the scrapbook that you, mm-hmm. you know, even in the Polka and the Bridget Berlin scrapbook, mm-hmm. someone went through it and marked who did what drawing on what page, but when it was done, no one really knew who did the drawing before or the drawing after or added that scrap or, you know, it was, it's not really about leaving a mark as an individual, it's about the sort of collective happening, in a sense, within the pages of a generic book.
Phil, is it something you partly... you've been interested in, you know, collective groups and publication very much. It's something which has some kind of resonance with your own interest.
No, very much. I mean, and I think what everyone's saying is, you know, extremely... valid to the sort of underlying appeal. Again, you know, Andrew used the word democratic. It's sort of, there's a quality even despite the kind of glittery quality of Bridget Berlin's scrapbook. There's something kind of very, I guess pedestrian's the wrong word, but very sort of ordinary about what people choose to put in their scrapbook. It's not meant, I love the fact that it's not meant to be fancy or it has no, the kind of private relationship it has with its owner and creator allows it to be something that isn't, meant to be precious. And I think that's a really wonderful aspect of it because it then, you know, shows what was perhaps of concern on a sort of daily basis. And that is always appealing to me, the sort of more democratic side of the art production, the less kind of elevated going for the gallery and museum context, the kind of thing that an artist might do because it was important to them to have a record of it, but not important, not done for, you know, for sale or not done for show or not done for a broad public response, but done for private purposes. It's always fun to peer into the, or attempt to peer into the private life of artists.
But I think, for instance, in the case of Burroughs and Geisen, I mean, that was something they did together. It was a true collaboration, and it was an activity that they shared, and I think that was critical to it. They may have been stoned, they may have been whatever, but they were doing it mm-hmm. together, and the product was evidence of this thing that happened between the two of them. And I think that was critical to the making of those scrapbooks.
And they did a lot of them. I mean, right. I mean, there's one in the, you know, in the exhibition, but they're probably, right, 10?
Three of them in the...
But 10 of, or 12 of them known?
Yeah, probably around a dozen made. Yeah. And one of those, Burroughs, in 1979, did reproduce in a small edition of 30 copies in color Xerox. A publisher in Paris, a gallerist and publisher in Paris, Claude Givaudan bought a group of the scrapbooks, and with Burroughs' permission, they did this edition of 30 copies. Only 29 were actually realized, and they're signed and they're numbered, and they were sold the night they were made, actually, and everyone sold that same night. That's how the story goes.
I mean, would you add something which exists in your work, too, between like the presentation of the photograph or the installation-like setting and the publication is between something which you put the viewer in a very different position each time, you know, being or in an environment where you are more like in an archive-like setting or more like really a reader just going through the different pages, you know, of your work. Could you just talk a little bit about how suddenly a project become a book and how this book...
Yeah, I mean, the project that's mentioned here, or that's included in the scrap, or in the paperwork book right here, is... it consists of an exhibition, which is a unique piece that has a scrapbook nature to it in some sense. There's a ordering, the way it's ordered in relation to diptychs, which are read against each other, almost as two pages would be read. And so, as I alluded to a little bit before, it took this basic premise, which I guess just I'll mention very, very quickly. In relation to the Rocky book, I basically had been married for 5 years and divorced for 5 years, and asked my ex-wife to go with me to a small cabin upstate New York for 4 days, photographed her over that period of time, and that rendered roughly 500 images, which was one sort of collection of images that went into the work. 2 months following this, her current husband and her agreed to go back alone to the same location, repeat the trip, and he photographed her over that period of time. So it was these two sets of images placed into a sort of dialectical conversation. That was the first kind of comparative dimension of the project. In the exhibition, those exist as two small vitrines that contain every image that was actually made. So it's a kind of non-edit in a sense. It's a kind of really a kind of, the vitrines function as kind of containers for it. That was replicated in one book, which presents all of my images on the verso side and all of his images on the recto side, as sort of itemized. You know, it just itemizes the images and really treats them as equivalent. Then the work here, Ephemera, which is reproduced, that was a larger vitrine that basically was a collection of images that I had culled from magazines, you know, stretching from 1920s on into now and on into this moment, and you know, all sorts of different things: advertising, lifestyle, gay and straight pornography, you know, various different medias. It was sort of a paper sort of landscape in a way, a kind of cultural landscape, and I was. You know, in the vitrine setting, that's presented as a kind of pile of material. It's maybe 6,000 or 7,000 pieces. In the way I did the book is, or these magazines that I made, it's roughly 480. It's 480 pages, and what I did is I took 479 sequenced pieces of that ephemera and downshot them on a copy stand. Each time it was a photograph of that same copy stand, and you would turn a page, and each time one of the pieces of ephemera was taken off, and so
it's essentially a stack of printed matter you lift up and then take a shot, and then you turn it into six fascicles.
Absolutely, and the bottom of the last page is basically just the image of the copy stand, so it's kind of exhausted the entire stack by the time you get to the end of it. And then there's a set of diptychs, which again are a sort of scrapbook as well, which was those were the wall works in the installation, but they also compose a second book as well. And those, in a way, are the integration of these two systems, so the kind of comparative dimension of the two sets of photographs of the same woman, which you always have to understand from the position of the newlywed relationship or the exhausted relationship. And then the private images set against the public images. So in a way, those public images became the kind of models for the private images, but also a means of performing a reading on them. So there was that kind of recursive dimension in integrating the two into yet again another scrapbook.
And in that case, the scrapbook basically followed the installation? You know, how did it, you know, was it a way to just sort out what you had done and give it a form of, you know, a visualization of an extremely complex project, which, of course, when you talk about thousands of images, it begs the question of the selection and how are you going to give that a more final or presentation.
In a way, they invert each other. So the published version ends up, in a sense, also privileging the the public material, you know, the material from the magazine pages and this stuff. So, and there's also a poster version of this, and so it kind of flips the hierarchy it situates the personal within this sort of broader media landscape in a sense.
Maybe Alex, we talk a little bit about the selection process which led to that exhibition. You know, in fact, I think the selection started with the Ray Johnson book that he made when he was 14 years old, and ends with Lee's books made last year. Mm-hmm. So, what were the different functions or role that you wanted to record in that exhibition of the scrapbook? Because you have very, very different, you know, publication. If you think of Atlas of Richter, it's hardly a scrapbook. You know, I mean, you could see it as a scrapbook, but there's a stretch a little bit here to, or even Hans-Peter Fellmann's, you know, publication. They kind of all relate to each other, but they could be qualified very differently.
Well, it was interesting to hear Lee talk about this kind of notion of doubling, because with the Ray Johnson scrapbook, which was the earliest one, which was actually, though he went on to be an artist, created at a moment in his life where he could have been anything. He was a teenager when he made it. But that was mirrored in the exhibition by an artist, Brian, help me with the pronunciation of his last name, Buzak, who made a photocopy of it later, which was, you know, maybe a more contemporary form of gathering or collecting information. So there was an idea, I think, of artists speaking to one another across the exhibition. And I think perhaps if we had been stricter, we would have done a kind of 60s, 70s New York, and I think I should say kind of queer New York, too, in a sense, because this has been kind of hinted at, but I think there's a strong quality of sexuality in these books, just on the level of content. On the certain hand, they're kind of spaces of practice where artists are grabbing hold of material and kind of seeing what it might do, but they're also kind of spaces of pleasure, and I think there's one kind of falls into the next. So there's these kind of little coteries of scrappers, and you get the sense that they were actually kind of shared amongst a certain kind of group. I think the way we got to the Richter is because I was thinking of Isa Genskin's great monumental scrapbook, I Love New York, which is a kind of real scrappy scrapbook. And then again, thinking of these kind of social worlds, Genskin and Richter, of course, at one point were a couple. So to think about, you know, is there a kind of shared logic, or how were images circulating in that world? Also, you know, that we think of Richter as being very removed from this kind of activity of very kind of hand-wrought kind of private activity. But of course, the beginnings of Atlas, I don't think it was in any way clear that it was necessarily going to be an artistic project and a kind of index by which he would generate his paintings, but in fact had to do with his emigration from East Germany and literally a kind of collection of photographs and keepsakes that then became kind of infiltrated once he moved to the West by similar things than as to what Lee is speaking about, you know, industrial pornography, banal images cut out of the newspaper. And so there's this kind of infiltration of kind of the public image into the space of the private image. And I think that's one of the reasons that's so interesting about Richter's project. So, you know, there's certain ways you can say it's not really a scrapbook, but I think there was a little provocation in doing that to, you know, there's such a kind of language attributed to Richter. He's allowed to look somewhat exceptional, and to kind of bring him into this other company was maybe an attempt to read him against the grain a little bit. If we had been stricter, of course, maybe we would have done another German scrapbooks, 60s through 80s, or even up to 90s and 2000s. We have Monica Baer, for example, who we saw a little bit of her book before Bridget Berlin, and others as well. But then, you know, you see other affiliations with Richard Prince's kind of tear sheet archive, you know, perhaps really speaks to Richter's project more than any of the other ones. So we were Catholic in our tastes, but the more the merrier, perhaps.
The relationship, or more even the opposition between Genske and Richter, makes me think of what Phil was saying at the beginning of this talk, saying that some of those books look forward and some look backward. Mm. If you think of Richter's Atlas, it's really something looking backward, trying to. It's an index of, you know, images that he collected for various reasons. Some of them became paintings, some did not. But for Genske, it's a completely different thing. It's something like an artist suddenly isolated in a hotel in New York, having a very hard time to cope with the world, and the scrapbook is the only way to bring all those ideas together, and in a way paves the way for many, many years to come in Genske's practice, you know, if you think about architecture and the role of New York City and so on. So, Phil, could you just expand a bit of what you started?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't done it. No, I'm not going to talk about the Genske.
More about, you know, how you can differentiate those scrapbooks and their role in artist practices.
And again, I think it. I'm one of the reasons I love the show, and I think everyone should have the book and refer to it extensively, is that there's a lot more thinking that needs to be done about artist scrapbooks. I really believe that, because I think it's a sort of unexamined aspect of art history and artists generally, and I think they're extremely revealing. And we're also seeing, I think, some scrapbooks from some artists who are, in general, sort of underappreciated. The John Evans, I mean, that was an amazingly brilliant series of very, very carefully done collages of great sort of visual elegance. And that, in my way, was sort of a way in which he was coping with where he was in his, as an artist, and what he was doing, and his own sort of personal sort of interest in doing something remarkable and finished every day that nobody wanted even to look at. So it was put into a book of the kind, and he made, I don't know if anyone checked, but there must be
quite a few,
since he did one every day. And, you know,
Hansen's spiral-bound notebooks.
Or big series,
made
right.
For a decade.
Right.
And he made, there were just generic artist sketchbooks, spiral-bound, oversized. And he numbered every page. He made them for a decade. And he went through 27 notebooks and 2,500 and some odd pages. And it was just that decade of the 70s that he did that. But it was like Evans in that every day he would, whatever he found that day, he would turn into some, either it would just be slapped down on a page and glued there, or it would actually be collaged with other material that he had found that day. So it was kind of a daily activity.
Mm-hmm. And one of my favorites, to sort of maybe get closer to an answer to your question, is the Jimmy DeSanta scrapbook, which is simply a series of loose cuttings where he didn't even go to the finality of pasting them down. He inserted them into sleeves that would actually sort of hold a large number. And one of the great excitements of actually looking at that scrapbook, as you might or as he might, really, they appear different each time, because there's movement of the, sometimes something that's on top will be to the side, and something that's on, just as you were describing your own more deliberate process of the removal, the structure of, physical structure of Jimmy DeSanta's scrapbook does almost what you were describing by virtue of the sort of physical content. And that sort of suggested to me that he was perhaps putting images aside for him to be inspired from later. hence my notion of scrapbooks which serve a purpose of not memorializing, but perhaps of spurring further thought and content and about what might happen in the future, or what an artist might look to for the future. And you might comment on that.
I think he would have called it a scrapbook, by the way.
We won't know that.
No, I know, but I mean, we're calling it a scrapbook. But it may have just been a place where he was storing bits and pieces of images, and they got layered that way.
Call that a scrapbook. He took scraps, right, and he put them into a book.
Right, but called his scrapbook scrapbooks, and Genskin calls that a scrapbook. But I don't know if Desano would have called... We're calling it a scrapbook, but I think it was just sort of like a place to store...
Whose side is this guy on?
I don't know.
No, I mean, it's just an example of one of the books we included that is a bit outside of a normal kind of scrapbook that an artist calls a scrapbook. It was more of just a place to store.
Well, you should all be the judge of whether it's a scrapbook or not.
I also like this notion of Burroughs suggesting that the scrapbook was a sort of tool to then use and ongoingly create something new out of. So the scrapbook as a kind of script, which is something that, of course, the Fluxus interest in scrapbooks is echoes. You know?
And can suddenly open just another dimension to an artist's practice. I mean, I once organized a show of Barry LeVay scrapbooks, you know, and Barry is really like a sculptor.
Barry LeVay.
And he made those kind of scrapbooks really... because he collects all those diagrams, you know, physics, mathematics, biology. At the same time, he loves to photograph his TV and programs on his TV. And those two things, like those kind of diagram and this image from the world, suddenly make sense together, you know, as a book, and suddenly led to sculptures and other works, you know. So in a way, it becomes like part of his own process, you know, at redefining his sculptural works. And that, I think what Phil said was absolutely right, that we should pay more attention to those objects because there is a content there that which is often nowhere else to be found. And often the sad thing about scrapbooks is that they are dismembered, you know, they are scattered around because, you know, what their content, you know, as sometimes value for some of it and less value for the rest. So, but at the same time, there's something so challenging about doing a show of scrapbook. You know, often they're hard to open, they're big, they're fragile, they stick.
And you can only show one page.
You can only show one page, and
which is why this film is
so brilliant, right?
Well, that was part of the challenge of making the book, was how to present the material to show what it really looks like and feels like. So thus, the book became so large because the material is shown to scale.
Because of Al Hansen.
No, because of Carolee Schneeman.
Oh, because of Carolee Schneeman. Yeah.
Carolee's was the largest, 17 by 15 inches or something.
Do you know of any scrapbook that maybe the artist wouldn't want the public to look at?
Like, most of them, I would say. Most of them are private. I think we're lucky that we got what we got. And I think most artists, you know, Richard Prince loaned his tear sheets, but they weren't for sale or anything. And I could only see two of them. Hans-Peter Feldmann actually was very generous and sent photographs of some of his personal scrapbooks. In the end, Alex and I decided that we wouldn't print in the book anything that we didn't have physically to exhibit. So we ended up putting Voyeur in, even though Feldman had sent us these beautiful spreads from his personal scrapbooks. But he wouldn't send the scrapbooks. So we thought, well, then we'll put Voyeur in because that was more public and we could exhibit those.
One book which seems to be so important to almost most of the artists selected in that show is Anna Herr mass media scrapbook, those photo montage of the early 30s. And that seems to be... Could you talk a little bit about the influence of that book and the idea of photo montage and how, you know, suddenly found, you know, a form in the scrapbook that nowhere else could be... could be found?
Well, that's... Alex discusses that in his essay.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the kind of scrapbook of all artists' scrapbook somehow. I mean, I actually wish I knew more about the kind of reception and knowledge of that book, because I learned about it in Maud Levin's book about Hannah Hook cut with a kitchen knife, but I don't know if that was widely published before. It's held in an archive in Berlin. Hannah Hook, the daughter artist and photo monteur. But one of the points she makes in that book, which is interesting, is that she's not treating images actually the same way in the scrapbooks as she does in her photo montages. So it's much more kind of being used as a source book in a sense. Maybe you're learning things about the body. You know, she has a number of kind of tiller girls, you know, in these kind of ornaments. She's kind of learning lessons about the body in the way she's organizing these images. But when she actually makes the photo montages themselves, they don't adhere to such a strict geometry. They're much more kind of explosive. So, you know, I think that's what was part of the interest in the books too, you know, trying to decide, well, what are these things? Are these artworks? Are they kind of studies? And sometimes I think you see them kind of take on lives of their own. They might start in a kind of just a place to gather thing, kind of retrospective, and then, you know, you tell the artist gets interested or begins to have a certain investment, and then maybe they become more like artworks, or they, as Phil said, they kind of become not retrospective but projective and lead to other projects outside of the book. But I think the variety of their lives are just like any book. They're kind of things to be used. And Lee mentioned Burroughs in particular. He kind of would use them to read out of, or you know, maybe he would read out of them as he would have be recording himself. So it's kind of part of this whole intermedia experience. And I think the books themselves obviously kind of speak to that grabbing from all different kind of sorts of places. But then, of course, this experience where you are kind of left with these, you know, musty books at the end. So what is their kind of life now? What is to kind of be done with them now? I mean, it's amazing just when the Bridget Berlin one finished, you could see on the black background, like, all the parts of it that had fallen off, you know. So they do now have a kind of relic-like quality or kind of artifactual quality that they may or may not have been intended to have. But maybe I think it's partially that kind of falling apart quality, which is, at least for me, kind of part of the draw, perhaps, at this moment where things seem maybe more seamless than cracking.
I think part of our attraction to this project also was is in the title of the book, in Paperwork.
Because can you talk a bit about that? Because I kind of had a hard time.
All these artists are working with paper still, you know, and they're handling paper, and they're cutting paper, and they're gluing paper. And they're doing a very primitive kind of activity. And, I mean, Alex came up with the title, which I thought was brilliant, although I resisted it at first, but then I went along with it, and I'm glad I did. But because it also references, you know, the paperwork that we each handle in our everyday lives. But in particular, and I think why this project may be timely, is that I think fewer and fewer artists are actually handling paper any longer. That, in fact, the scrapbooks of the present are tumblers and are, you know, are mediated and are at your fingertip but not with a scissor and paper. And so the physicality of the book, of these scrapbooks, was what attracted us, and perhaps in a bit of a nostalgic way, because that fewer and fewer of them, I think, are actually still being made.
Do people use scissors anymore at all? I mean, are they anyone cutting things out, or are they just sort of removing the background?
I think some artists in this audience still do.
Good.
Well, when you see the number of people coming to book fair, you can wonder that if it's really something which is nostalgic or something which is not very, still very much like a current practice. Maybe we should open the to the public and see if you have any question about.
So we're audio recording. Just raise your hand and I'll bring the microphone to you.
Thank you. Very interesting program. You refer to an exhibition. I must have missed something. I don't know what the exhibition was. And also, I'd like to ask another question. some of the papers you can see have fallen off and the person's hand sort of tries to position them. As a collector, if you see a picture that you know should be somewhere, do you glue it back in? Or do you leave it?
Why don't you answer about the question?
Oh, well, the project is both the book and an exhibition. I mean, we're discussing the book tonight, but a component of the project was also exhibiting the scrapbooks that are featured in the book. Oh, they were just recently exhibited at the New York Art Book Fair at PS1, but earlier in the year at my gallery over on 70th Street.
And on the sort of archival, you know, I mean, Richard Berlin is scrapbook is the most vivid example of something falling apart all the time and probably shouldn't be handled. But my philosophy as a collector owner, which my beautiful wife shares as well, is that, you know, these things are meant to be seen. They don't really, they're not meant to be treasured, precious objects that are kept in a vault away from light. And, you know, you have to accept the fact that, you know, not everything is permanent and not everything can last in its original state forever. And I'd rather, in the scale of things, tip the balance toward, you know, showing them, lending them, and having people enjoy them, to sort of keeping them or trying or pretending to keep them in pristine condition. Just probably not a standard view, to be honest, but certainly sort of my view, our view.
And it's really often books which don't come to you in pristine condition because they are diaries. They are things that people use
on
a daily basis. So they come to you already in a very poor condition.
Handled.
Right. The one scrapbook which I always am somewhat more troubled by than others is the Robert Mapplethorpe scrapbook. And I bought that from the estate with the understanding that I would leave it to a museum. And I take that responsibility seriously, so I worry about trying to at least get it to the museum in some reasonably decent condition. Although I'm confident they'll restore it.
But also the Mapplethorpe is an example of one of the scrapbooks, which is one of the more refined ones.
Yes.
Because it was really carefully constructed, and things fold out, and they make sense folded, and they make another sense opened up, and he was very careful about that. So, yeah, if Phil wouldn't glue it, I probably would have insisted he would. But no, we handled that one with care. So the Berlin is a different story.
Well, you know, an important character of contemporary art is its ephemeral nature,
yes,
which, you know, applies to this case. But I imagine that these scrapbooks must be a nightmare of conservationists and preservationists.
They will be for someone.
This one already has mold on it.
Foxy.
Well, earlier it looked like
thank you so much. I'm visiting from L.A., and I just was looking at the children's exhibit downstairs and saw the flyers, so I was excited to see this. Sadly, I have to leave early. But there's a very, I don't know about New York art, what's going on here, but in the West, there's a very large artist journal movement happening, and it's very popular. And it's, somebody was saying, do people really use scissors? Yes, we do. And there's been many, many exhibits in LA with many artist journals, local, well known, some not known. And it's a movement that's really popular, and many, many workshops being taught to new and old and young people. So I don't know what's going on here, but that's something that's happening where I live. My question is, how did you narrow down the number of scrapbooks that you call scrapbooks to include in this beautiful book that I just saw?
Well, we started with a core group from Phil's collection, which was about two-thirds of
think I may have done that, actually.
It's about two-thirds of the collection, and what we added, we sort of accessorized that core group. And since scrapbooks are kind of difficult to procure, it was also based on what we could find, and we went after certain things we couldn't put our hands on or that were locked away in an institution and we couldn't borrow or was too complicated to find. And so it was sort of based on the time period we were working within and the project limitations.
You know, I see these scrapbooks as sort of private, personal time capsules. So whether it's cut and pasted on paper or whether it's just cutouts inside plastic sheets, these are sort of, you know, private time capsules. And as has been said, they could be used as a basis for artist biographies. My question is, we have a gallerist, we have a collector, we have an artist. How do you go about determining the price structure on these scrapbooks?
Well, that's a difficult thing to discuss. Do you really want to get into that? I don't think we want to get into that. I don't want to get into it.
Well, let's just pick one. You know, for example, the William Burroughs Bryant.
I don't want to get into price. All right. Ellen, did you have a question?
It's going to be rambling, maybe. But the idea of, like, Jimmy DeSana and artists have files. They might not necessarily put them into scrapbooks.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know in how many years, but images that exist on paper are going to be, you know, not that accessible. Magazines, if newspapers in terms of digital newspapers, digital magazines. So it's almost this time period from, you know, in the future, maybe 10, 15 years into, you know, 1900s, you know, the 90s, the 80s, where this is material that should, I don't know, it should be looked at. It's so much because artists, but they have files and they you know, categorize it maybe for a particular project, images that you're collecting. For one project, it's filed by, you know, subcategory. So it's just pretty interesting because I don't think, well, people don't make photo albums like they used to. They take pictures on their iPhones, but they don't necessarily catalog them, unless they catalog them on a hard drive and keep them, and how much do they look at them, and then the touch of paper, and the cutting out, the activity of looking at a magazine and selecting something, and cutting it out, or cutting a section of it out, it's going to be a totally past.
A thing of the past.
Past. Anyway. Made me think of all that.
Did someone say Karen Schneider is in the audience? Hi, Karen. Did you want to say anything about filming the project?
Well, Karen didn't act as a... She didn't film the project. She made a movie as an artist that we exhibited as part of the exhibition. So she wasn't documenting the scrapbooks for us. She made her own film. Want to clarify that.
Yeah, and I, my history as a filmmaker, I come from 16mm film and Jonas Mikas is cool, but I decided in this particular piece, I decided to go the other way around, and I decided to take a position with the camera in which could be as neutral as possible and really just go to the entire exhibition page by page and trying to be really out of the any kind of composition structure. Although sometimes when I see the film, I see there's some kind of, it's not 100% rigor, and it's fine. But I did this together with another artist, Louise Ward, and we debate a lot about how to handle this. But
Karen, don't the movement of the hands make all the difference in a sense?
I agree.
Okay.
And David was our actor. And it was really amazing
show
to work with
your
him.
Hand.
Because he has he has the perfect pace, and he's very gentle when he moves. Yeah. And you see, like, at least when I was filming, and we were filming him, like, there's a lot of sensuality in his hands when he moves with the pages, and he's always, like, moving his hands in his particular forms, and it creates, like, a narrative. I totally agree with you that it's, like, a surplus with the film. And but that's the chord was try to be as neutral as possible and really, like, enjoy queer culture, which it's culture that I really support.
Well, the positioning of the hands also changes from the bottom of the screen to the top of the screen.
Yes.
Was there a specific reason for that, or did David want it to switch?
The light source.
Yeah.
Now, where can one see Scrapaggia in its entirety?
One, it's an architecture intervention. The second one is the video in itself. And the third one, I don't know exactly what's going to be yet, but that's what it is. It has three different
you
forms.
Can't actually see it, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah.
It's an artist's work. It's...
Yeah.
It's in private collections, not public yet.
Were there any other questions? Well, thank you so much for this most wonderful discussion, and most special thanks to Christophe Chatlis. It was an honor to have him here tonight. Thank you all for your attendance, and now it's time for book signing.